In India, farmers are entering their third month of big protests and getting celebrity attention.
This is going to be a huge boost for the farmers.
We'll hear what the farmers want. I'm Marco Werman. Also, Germany has done a lot to confront its Nazi past, but far-right extremism persists.
It's pretty much impossible to convince someone who doesn't want to be convinced, especially if their family shares their views.
And we remember Corky Lee, a New York City photographer who documented Asian American life and influenced one photographer from childhood.
He led the way. He made it possible for all of us, Chinese and Americans and Asian Americans in a way, because we all kind of walk in his footsteps.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to be with you today. The ongoing protests of tens of thousands of farmers in India are now entering their third month with no end in sight. The farmers are protesting inequality and new laws that further privatize agriculture, among other grievances, and they have found an unlikely ally, the pop singer Rihanna. Yesterday, Rihanna tweeted, "Why aren't we talking about this? Hashtag farmers protest," with a link to an article about an Indian government crackdown that included an internet blackout. Her comment went viral. Environmental activist Greta Thunberg has also chimed in, tweeting, "We stand in solidarity with the hashtag farmers protest in India." This support from global celebrities for the farmers has really annoyed the Indian government. Priyadarshini Sen is an independent journalist in Delhi who's been covering the protests. So Priya, if the world was not paying attention to the protests in Delhi, a lot more are now. Rihanna has 100 million plus followers, Greta Thunberg nearly 5 million. How has the Indian government responded to a lot of outrage they seem to have prompted online?
This is unprecedented. Several prominent voices have actually gone on Twitter and other social media platforms to draw attention to the farmer protests, and they've shown solidarity with the protests. And in response to that, there is a Bollywood star who's known to openly support the BJP government called Kangana Ranaut, who immediately, in response to Rihanna's tweet, says, I quote her, "No one is talking about it because they are not farmers. They are terrorists who are trying to divide India so that China can take over a vulnerable, broken nation and make it a Chinese colony, much like the US.
Wow.
So those who have been supporting these protests have been subjected to trolls, hate, online abuses, racist slurs, a host of abuses, really. And now this is being directed at the international community. In fact, the government today put out a sharp warning against the temptation of, in quotes, temptation of sensationalist social media hashtag on comments, and said the protests were only by a small section of farmers in selected parts of India. But what is very important, Marco, is the amplification of the international voices we are noticing at a time where the movement is being sought to repress and suppressed at any cost by the government. This is going to be a huge boost for the farmers.
So the celebrity tweets, as you say, it prompted pushback. What do you know about public support in India for these protests?
So the public support in India for the protests is actually growing massively. It's really gathering momentum. And it started when Parliament enacted these laws last September. In the government's eyes, the farming sector needed reform, and they believe that agricultural laws will give farmers greater market access and flexibility. But in response to the enactment of these laws, there was immediate protest against these laws. But the protests were mostly localized, and what really changed the narrative in a very drastic way was when the farmers started moving in hordes in convoys to Delhi to really protest against these laws. So November 26th, they landed on the borders of Delhi and they started camping on the borders of Delhi.
And just to be clear, why do Indian farmers fear those new laws will imperil their livelihood and their work?
So currently there are regulated markets that allow farmers to sell their produce at a minimum support price. This has allowed them to keep afloat and allow agriculture to remain sustainable. So what these laws will do is they will allow corporates to enter into direct contract with farmers, bypass those regulated markets. And in the process, farmers fear that it would lead to the disappearance of the local markets called mandis. They want the market minimum support price to remain operational. And if that's gone, they'll just be pawns in the hands of the corporates. And these corporates will be dictating the prices as well as the crops that should be harvested. And farmers will also, in the process, lose their land. The government has said that they are willing to have further talks with the farmers till they come to a consensus. And they've even agreed to put the laws on hold up to 18 months. The farmers have said that they are not going to step down. They are not going to move from the protest sites till the laws are fully repealed and they get their due.
Prime Minister Modi says that farmers' anger is being stoked by opposition politicians and the farmers don't understand that the new laws will help them. Does he have a point?
The government is using the farm protests as a pretext to level all kinds of charges against the opposition, saying that it's a conspiracy by the opposition to really besmirch the government and show it in a poor light. The opposition is bringing people together and building solidarity. So this is a really, after independence, this is a historic moment in India, and it's going to change a lot of things, even if the laws aren't repealed. The farmers have been arriving in such large numbers and camping out in Delhi's harsh winter, staying in tents, living out of their tractors and trolleys. They don't want that. They want to be in the comfort of their homes. Yet I think it's the community spirit that has really kept this movement sparklingly alive, despite the brutal crackdowns and intimidations. They are voicing their protests against inequalities and injustices that they've silently suffered over several decades.
Priyadarshini Sen is a journalist in Delhi who's been covering the farmers' protests in the Indian capital. Priya, thank you very much for your time and for your explanations.
Thank you, Marco.
The pandemic has brought along its fair share of viral food trends, and some credit goes to TikTok, where a lot of these trends gain traction. The latest is a craze over fufu, fufu being the starchy staple in West African cooking. The World's Bianca Hillier has a story on how fufu became a thing.
When Keith Otoo posted his first TikTok of fufu, nobody really watched.
Today we have okra soup, eating with gari or fufu.
I posted it, it didn't take off, so I didn't think nothing of it.
But then Keith, who's from Cameroon, posted another fufu video.
So we're gonna go ahead and eat. So you wanna break your fufu and then just dip it.
This time, the elusive TikTok algorithm did its thing.
That one went absolutely nuts. And people are like, oh my God, what is that?
It's so good, man.
Fufu is a soft, spongy, stretchy dough eaten with all kinds of soups and stews in West Africa.
Fufu goes with any soup, like with okra, with vegetable soup, even with spinach.
Nigerian chef Joyce Edom says fufu is one of the most common foods in the region, but making it can be a laborious task. She walks through the process on her YouTube channel.
Now, all you need to do is to bring the cassava into a white pot.
First, you boil cassava, a starchy root vegetable. Fufu can also be made with yuca, white yams, or plantains. But no matter the ingredient, the next step is to mash and pound the mixture until it's thick.
Well, you have to stay this hard enough to dissolve the lumps and so that everything comes together.
Some people on TikTok say the finished product looks like mashed potatoes, but you don't eat fufu with a spoon. Instead, Adam says fufu becomes the spoon.
You fetch just a little portion, just like a small ball, and mold it with your hand. Then you make a dent with your finger. Then you dip it inside the soup. As you dip it inside the soup and place it in your mouth, you're supposed to like lick your finger.
Lick your fingers, slurp the soup, and then swallow whole. No chewing, she says, if you want to do it right. On TikTok, fufu videos have been watched nearly 310 million times. All this attention on such a staple dish is something fellow Nigerian chef Lola Oshankalu never expected.
Of all dishes, we have our rice meals, we have beans, we have everything. It's fufu that is trending. It's really surprising.
Surprising and welcomed, Chef Oshenkolu moved from Nigeria to California 10 years ago and says she's excited about seeing more food from the continent in the U.S.
Oftentimes, you know, the knowledge about African food is limited when you leave Africa. So I'm glad because the beauty of African food is coming out there to the public and people are seeing and appreciating it. It gladdens my heart.
Most TikTok reviews are positive.
So it looks delicious and it smells so good.
And let's just grab a little bit.
Scoop it. That was so worth it.
But the internet is the internet. And some people trying fufu for the first time don't like it. Keith Otowo says he's seen videos of people spitting it out and scraping their tongue.
You know, that's not only demeaning, but is disrespectful to a culture. Like, it's okay not to like food, but there's a difference between not liking food and disrespecting it.
If you taste fufu and don't like it, there are a lot of other West African dishes to try, says Ghanaian-American chef Eric Ajapong.
Bofrot is like a West African donut, often called puff puff. Stews, like the peanut butter soups and the light soups, jollof rice is a huge deal.
No matter what dish you choose, Chef Joyce Edom in Nigeria says she's thrilled for this focus on West African cuisine.
Our food, our local food, becoming very popular. It's getting attention. It makes me really happy and I'm so proud of it.
Proud and newly popular herself. Edom says her own videos on YouTube have seen a spike in views as TikTok users rush to learn more about fufu. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Organizers of the Göteborgs Film Festival in Sweden wanted the show to go on this year despite the pandemic, so they're screening films a little differently on an isolated island in an abandoned lighthouse for an audience of one. A Swedish nurse named Lisa Enroot, she was chosen from 12,000 applicants and is posting videos chronicling her week-long experience on YouTube. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has been watching them back-to-back, Wrapped.
I'm Lisa. I am the chosen one.
Lisa is instantly likable. She has messy pink hair and an easy smile. And in this first video, she's just a little shell-shocked.
So strange. Okay, so I have not regretted it yet, but we'll see.
I don't know how you feel about this experiment. If you think that a week alone in nature watching movies sounds like heaven, Lisa will tell you you are correct. But if you think it's like The Shining, where you get creeped out and gradually go insane, you'd also be correct. The first thing that strikes Lisa is the beauty of the place.
This is so nice. I hope you can hear the waves. It's great.
And then there are movies, movies, and more movies. On day three, Lisa talks to us from her lighthouse. You can hear the echo. She talks about the Spanish film Rosa's Wedding, about a 45-year-old woman who marries herself.
It is a possibility that I, in a few years, could be having a wedding with myself is a really big risk, actually.
As the days go on, the isolation takes its toll.
I started talking to myself. No, who am I kidding? I started to talk to the oven.
Feelings that have been bottled up come out. Lisa talks about the hunger for hugs, for a friend, for a connection, especially after all the months working in the hospital.
I believe that everyone who has been affected of corona in any way, working with it or losing someone important or catching it, we need to talk. We need to talk so much more than we do.
The festival organizers said they devised this unusual showing to draw attention to our social isolation. It's also a gimmick to draw attention to the festival. And it works. Lisa Enroot's YouTube posts are almost like a film all on their own. And viewers are flocking to the show. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The riot at the U.S. Capitol last month quickly drew comparisons to events during the rise of Nazi Germany, but Germany also offers lessons on how to counter anti-Semitism and far-right extremism. A recent rise of nationalism in Germany, though, proves that the work is ongoing. With support from the Pulitzer Center, Ryan Delaney reports in Erfurt, Germany.
Eula Grauman had heard enough from her classmates. Fellow students at her high school in a small city in eastern Germany would say mean things about Syrian refugees living there. And then there were insensitive comments in history class about World War II. Outside of school, she says she'd also hear trash talk on the soccer field aimed at non-native players.
Most of them wanted to make fun, but sometimes it escalated and there were conflicts between parents.
It inspired Grauman to start an anti-racism group at her school. Members try to raise awareness about being respectful of one another.
I think this is the problem. Lots of young people doesn't think they're of their opinions and of their comments in a real way. They sometimes aren't aware of what they do to others.
Grauman gets support from one of several national organizations in Germany confronting racism, the Network for Democracy and Courage, or NDC. Annika Ferba is one of its trainers. She goes into schools to lead discussions with kids.
They are attentive. They listen to you. They participate.
But there's also plenty of awkward silence.
Well, in school, especially when you talk about politics or when you talk about refugees, I think this is when those thoughts come up.
The idea behind the work of NDC and similar organizations is to preach tolerance and democracy before xenophobia hardens with age, says Gio Hoffman, another NDC instructor.
I've learned pretty quickly that it's pretty much impossible to convince someone who doesn't want to be convinced, especially if their family shares their views and if their friends share their views.
Zilk Baer is co-founder of Cultures Interactive, another anti-racism nonprofit. She says a few days of discussions in schools has to counterbalance what's on social media and what kids hear at home.
Young people act out the racist attitudes of their parents or what they hear around.
In the past year, there have been several high-profile arrests of German police officers and soldiers who were connected with extremist groups. Felix Steiner is with MOBIT, an organization that works to combat hate crimes. Steiner says there aren't necessarily more racist people in Germany, but he says it's gotten easier to share the messaging and spread the hate.
You don't need anything, you just need a computer or a mobile phone, and so you're in contact with these people.
He says the boot and trench coat wearing neo-Nazis of the 1990s have faded away. Now, members of the far-right political party Alternative for Germany, for example, wear business suits, and they spread their ideology on social media and even in video games.
It's a way to get in, and then you are confronted with all this racist stuff and anti-Semitic stuff and so on, and this is the way it works.
The Alternative for Germany has lost some steam from its peak popularity a few years ago, but anti-government protests have been common in Germany throughout the pandemic. They were sparked in part by conspiracy theories about the coronavirus lockdown. In Munich last fall, far-right protesters chanted, "Join us." And at another rally, protesters rushed the steps of the parliament building in Berlin. Unlike what happened on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, the protesters did not break in. Michael Brenner is a history professor who splits his time between American University in Washington and a university in Munich. He says it took a few decades after World War II for them to start the process, but he says Germans have been working long and hard to confront their difficult past.
Germany has done, I would say, a very good job in making very clear that the Holocaust and how it came to both the Nazi rule and the Holocaust has to be taught in schools.
There are not a lot of studies on the extent of extremism among German youth, but researchers say what they do know is that there's a small but persistent element, and it can turn dangerous if left alone. For The World, I'm Ryan Delaney, Erfurt, Germany.
So what can Americans learn from Germany about how to confront our own racist history? Philosopher Susan Nyman has grappled with this. Nyman is the author of Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. She's in Berlin. So I want to start with a German concept you point to, working off the past. I won't attempt the seven-syllable word. What is that word and what does it mean?
It's called Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung. There are a couple of variations on the concept, but that's the one that I prefer. And it refers to the process that a nation has to go through in order to confront, atone for, and repair its violent and racist past.
Let's talk about what working off the past looks like in Germany practically. Anybody who's visited Berlin may know, for example, that the memory of the past is very visible. Basically, right next to the Reichstag building is the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe. I don't know if it would be an accurate analogy, but it seems like it'd be like a memorial to the victims of slavery right next to the U.S. Capitol. What are the elements of this, and how does that work into the daily lives of everyday Germans?
The analogy is exactly right, and I don't know why we don't have a memorial to enslaved African Americans and murdered Native Americans on our National Mall. I'm glad we have two museums, but it's not quite the same thing as a memorial. And that memorial is only the biggest and most central of many hundreds that are scattered throughout Berlin. There are almost no monuments that honor members of the Wehrmacht or any members of the Nazi Party. And at the same time, when one comes to Berlin, you see reminders of the history all over the place. So that those who oppose taking down statues of Johnny Reb or Confederate generals because they're afraid we'll forget their history really do need to take a look at Germany, because Germans have not forgotten their history, although there are no statues honoring Nazis or Wehrmacht soldiers.
Susan, have you thought about or seen compelling proposals about how working off the past could look in the United States? And how does it start?
Memorials are not about history. They're about values. And for communities to come together and both learn the history of those monuments, why and when they were put up, but then also to debate about what should replace them, what are the values that we want our communities to have, that's a very important process and part of working off the past. Another very important part is popular culture. One thing that was very important in Germany to understand something about the Holocaust was memoirs of survivors, and at least in East Germany, there were a lot of films made about the Nazis, simply to get a window into other perspectives. And I think we've been doing this pretty decently in the United States. We're going to have a harder job with school textbooks, because there's no national authority for school textbooks. And what a child learns in Texas is very different from what a child learns in Massachusetts. We need a balanced, nuanced description of our history, which includes the crimes we've committed, no question about it. But it also needs to convey that in every epoch of American history, there were people who stood up for justice against those crimes. It's going to be a long process. It's not something that can be solved, you know, in a year or two, but that is something that very much needs to happen.
Susan Nyman is a philosopher and author of Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. She's been speaking with us from Berlin. Thank you very much for your time, Susan.
It's a pleasure, Marco.
In Zimbabwe, mental health is being tended to by grandmothers. They're in high demand during the pandemic. That's coming up in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. More candidates with immigrant roots have won office. One politician hopes others have a smoother path.
I really want to make sure that it's not as hard as it was for me.
And the backstory to an iconic photograph.
Corky had a ladder. He had a loudspeaker, and, you know, it's not easy to corral 500 people, but he did.
Recasting history later on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Communities across Africa are some of the best equipped for responding to infectious diseases. There's contact tracing expertise built up from Ebola outbreaks. There's surveillance and testing labs in place for other diseases like polio. None of this, though, has prevented many countries on the continent from seeing a sharp rise in cases of COVID-19. African countries face another big challenge. Very few vaccines have reached them. This week, the first rounds of vaccines finally landed in South Africa, one of the countries hardest hit by the pandemic. Dr. Ahmed Ogwell Uma is deputy director for the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Dr. Uma, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with vaccines. What do you make of this imbalance in how vaccines are distributed around the world, with places like the U.S. and Europe at the top of the list? What does that mean for countries in Africa?
Our position is that it must be equitable. And this is precisely because the longer we take to bring this pandemic under control, the more variants will be seen around the world. And with each new variant, It will mean that the earlier efforts in putting vaccines into the world market will be almost null and void. So if we do not ensure that vaccination is happening everywhere in the world, including Africa, then we are not going to get a good hold of this pandemic in a timely manner.
Well, right now, it is not equitable. In fact, there is a disturbing trend. Countries are scrambling and competing to secure vaccine supplies for their people. I mean, it's happening through bilateral deals, and a lot of African countries have largely been left out of those deals. So how are you confronting this global challenge that risks putting the African continent specifically at a serious disadvantage?
We are doing three things. The first is we have a very clear COVID-19 vaccine strategy that we are implementing currently, whose main elements include being part of development processes, including clinical trials. Second thing is, as Africa CDC and the Africa Union, we are negotiating directly with all the manufacturers that have vaccine candidates that either have been already licensed or are showing promising results. And market in Africa is huge. It is 1.3 billion people. We have also negotiated with our financial institutions on the continent to make available the required resources to purchase these vaccines. The third thing that we are doing is we are informing in no uncertain terms all the countries that have vaccine manufacturing capability. And we as Africa are watching very closely how these countries will be able to respond to the need for equity with a clear view of who our friends are and who will not be exactly friendly to the vaccine needs of Africa.
I'm speaking with Dr. Ahmed Ogwell Umah. He's the Deputy Director for the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I mean, the variant discovered in South Africa in particular appears a little less effective with some vaccines and treatments. The WHO has called on African nations to boost their surveillance of the virus. So how are you tracking this and what have you found and what do you think is needed to enhance that tracking?
What we are seeing is that the virus is spreading. This variant from South Africa is actually spreading. And we have already seen it in about six other countries on the continent. And we are working with the countries where it is affected to ensure that the hotspots where the variant has been identified can quickly be able to be secured. Secondly is we are using pathogen genomics as a new tool for surveillance. And the capacity on the continent, it was at nearly zero at the beginning of last year, 2020. And right now we are at almost eight countries and we expect that to double over the next 2 or 3 months.
In addition to the variants, many communities across Africa are now dealing with a second wave of coronavirus and a sharp rise in cases. Why do you think that is and what worries you the most?
So far, about 40 countries out of the 55 countries in Africa are seeing the second wave. And thankfully, the vast majority are not related to the new variant. Indeed, we are associating the rise in the numbers of newly diagnosed cases with the holiday season. We hope that we should be able to see reduced numbers over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Finally, Dr. Umah, let's just step back for a moment. And I want to know how you see this pandemic ending or what you predict will happen with COVID-19 in Africa based on what you've been learning.
Predicting is very complex. But what we are seeing and what we are learning across time is that governments are acting together, including the vaccine area of work. We expect that when the vaccines arrive, the impact is going to be felt, particularly amongst the health workers, rapidly, and this will be able to change some of the hesitation that some parts of the population may have with the vaccines. And with the rollout of vaccines taken into the population, we expect that it will slow down the spread of the virus. Finally, this particular pandemic is teaching us more lessons. We learned lessons during Ebola and we set up Africa CDC. During this time, my expectation is that member states in Africa are going to actually take the lessons seriously, implement them effectively, and will be even better prepared for the next outbreak or the next pandemic.
Dr. Ahmed Ogwell Umah is Deputy Director for the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's been speaking with us from Addis Ababa. Very good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The pandemic has taken a huge mental health toll across the globe, but mental health care is not always easy to access. In Zimbabwe, one program is taking an innovative approach to this dilemma. It's called Friendship Bench. And for the last 10 years, it's trained members of the community, often grandmothers, to lend a supportive ear to those struggling with anxiety or depression. Ruth Verhey is a program director of Friendship Bench. It's a catchy name, but it's actually a pretty good description, Ruth, of how the program delivers its services. Just explain how it works.
So it works in a way that people are sitting on a bench together, which came from the necessity to find a space to offer this mental health program, which was not present at the primary healthcare clinics before. The only place we could get was put out a bench outside. And this is where people meet the trained and supervised grandmothers who are elderly community health workers, really, who are working as health promoters and who we trained up to deliver a basic mental health program called problem-solving therapy. So they get trained in basic counseling skills and help clients to work through their own problems without sort of going into what is traditionally happening in many parts of the world, which is advice giving.
And why are grandmothers in particular in a unique position to provide this service?
We believe that these women are particularly well-placed because they live in the same communities as their clients, meaning they really know the ins and outs of what is happening in the communities and people's lives. Often they know the people, have been knowing them for a long time, which might sound a little bit strange for the Western ear when you think of how we do psychology in the West. This is a very private thing. And these things came up in the beginning as well. People were very worried about confidentiality and being seen. This has now changed a little bit over time, we feel. So there's definitely more awareness of the grandmothers offering the service and of people taking up the service and feeling more comfortable. And especially now during the COVID pandemic, we are not as able to deliver the services on the bench as many of the primary healthcare clinics are very reduced in their service offerings. So the grandmothers are, again, perfectly placed because they're basically doing their outreach work in the communities.
Is it still on a bench, though?
No, not necessarily, because obviously they can't take the bench with them. They go wherever they find somewhere. This might be, as we're getting reports, it might be at the public water pump where they're having a chat, or at the marketplace, or at someone's house in the garden, or at the maize field, the corn field, where people right now are sort of tending their crops. So this could be any place that seems conducive for both counselor and client.
So kind of socially distanced talk therapy.
Absolutely, wearing masks.
Right. You mentioned the different new places that the Friendship Bench has kind of gone to, water pumps or a backyard. Have you moved online during the pandemic?
Yes, we have moved online. We are offering the program mostly via using WhatsApp, because that is the one that is mostly used in our setting here. It has a lot of challenges, and one that is the biggest challenge for people is just the costliness of it. So other challenges that are being explained to us are that people share phones, or again, it is even more complicated to have a private space with a phone, and often connectivity is disturbed as we are. A lot of people wouldn't have access to Wi-Fi, so it's really just the network connectivity, and that is often not as well happening. And then, like I said, the costs are a problem. So calls might be interrupted and also just shorter. So we as Friendship Bench, we are supporting financially the grandmothers to be able to reach out to clients. And we're learning of how this all works best. Interestingly enough, we are being told by our counselors that clients are still preferring to see people face to face.
These are grandmothers, though, high-risk group. How soon will they be able to get vaccinated? Are they already?
No, we have not had vaccinations happening here in Zimbabwe, to my knowledge. And this is absolutely one of our main concerns. So we have distributed masks. We explain all the COVID regulations that have to be adhered to. And the grandmothers, being health promoters, are being educated about that from the employer, from the health city health authorities as well. And there are those very, very dedicated and continue to do their work just as because they find it so important and so fulfilling and meaningful.
Ruth Verhey is a psychologist and program director at Friendship Bench, a community-based mental health care organization in Zimbabwe. Thank you for your time and for the work you're doing.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening.
Next, we're going to Southern California, where two large cities, Tijuana and San Diego, share a border. For years, San Diego was considered a Republican stronghold, but demographics have shifted with a growing community of young professionals and new immigrants. Now, Democrats have the edge. From San Diego, Max Rivlin-Nadler with KPBS reports on how one Latina has changed politics in that county.
Happy Sunday from National City, where it's actually raining a lot. But I'm knocking on doors because I know that this election is super important.
Nora Vargas walked in the rain in National City, a few miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border, going door to door asking people to support her campaign. This was during the primary elections last year. She was running for County Board of Supervisors, where there hadn't been a competitive election in 25 years. So when Vargas would show up at her neighbors' doors asking for their vote, it took some trust building.
Folks in the community told me, we're going to give you a chance, but we're going to be watching because politicians come here, they ask us for things, and then they never come back. And I think that's the piece that's really important, right? We have to deliver for our communities.
Latinos in San Diego County had never been elected to the Board of Supervisors, in a county where they make up 33% of the population. But that changed in November's election.
The results are showing Nora Vargas with a healthy lead at 54.5%.
Vargas, a Planned Parenthood executive, became the first Latina and immigrant on the Board of Supervisors. She was born in Tijuana. Her mother was a U.S. citizen, her father a Mexican citizen, something that's pretty common in this cross-border community. Going back and forth between two nations is where she believes her political journey began.
I think when I realized that I was in a very unique state because I was able to cross the border, and that's when it hit me. What can I do to make the world better for other people? And I think it's politics was an avenue for me to do that.
For Latinas in San Diego, there wasn't a roadmap to political power. So Vargas had to look elsewhere.
To be a Mexicana, a Latina, and then later on, what my friends would say, an honorary Chicana. I really count my blessings that I grew up in a family where going out away to college was actually encouraged, that I needed to see the world.
Watching her own mother work in local nonprofits and her grandmother run a cross-border business, she told me they were unintentional feminists, a perspective she brought to a Jesuit university in San Francisco.
Having those conversations about what feminism was and what women's rights were, and then me trying to figure out, well, what does that mean to communities of color and for people who don't have access or opportunities?
Vargas found a place at Planned Parenthood, where she eventually became an executive.
You know, I was a patient at Planned Parenthood. In my household, we didn't talk about sex or sexuality, reproductive health. There's a lot of myths in the Latino community. There's a lot of taboo around speaking about sexuality.
Access to health care was a fundamental part of her campaign. The county's Board of Supervisors has the power to build new hospitals and curb pollution. But in San Diego, for decades, that board has been monochromatic and entirely Republican.
Particularly since the 90s, the board would definitely had a complexion. It was an all-white board.
That's University of San Diego politics professor Carl Luna. He explains that in California, the Board of Supervisors holds the money bags.
They are the portal for state programs. Seldom in any other place in America do five people have so much power.
Vargas is carrying an extra burden. Her fellow supervisors recognize that they need her experience to serve every community in the county. Vargas was immediately put in charge of the county's vaccine distribution efforts to the Latino community. She believes that reaching the community in ways they'll not only understand, but also trust, is the key to ending the pandemic in Latino border communities, which have been devastated by COVID-19.
I'm talking and then I can do code switch like that and I can empiezo a platicar en español y por qué las cosas son importantes. And I think I did it today, right? We were talking about environmental justice and some of the work that we're doing because language shouldn't be a barrier.
Latinas in particular are leading the way into political office in the state and the country, says Dr. Inez Gonzalez. She runs Mana de San Diego, a national organization helping Latinas get involved in public service.
People want to make a difference. They need to figure out where the power is. There's certain boards, for example, water district boards, that really people don't pay attention to.
They pushed Vargas to join her first nonprofit board, and they want young Latinas, who turned out in November's election, to start running for office. For Vargas, that's the most important part of her journey. She's hired several young community organizers to work for her.
I really want to make sure that it's not as hard as it was for me. My commitment is to try to make sure that the system is really shaken so that the opportunities are there for women and communities of color to rise.
She hopes that after her, San Diego County politics will never be the same. For The World, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego.
We like to say radio is just like TV, but the pictures are better. Well, guess what? You can take a visual dive into the stories you hear on The World every day. Follow us on Instagram to see some of the people and places behind the voices you hear. And share your thoughts with the Twitter community. We're at theworld.org/Instagram. Last week, there was this news. Photographer Corky Lee died in New York City at the age of 73. His family said the cause was COVID-19. To say he is legendary, well, for many, that's an understatement. For decades, Lee chronicled the everyday life and struggles of Asian Americans. He once said in an interview that every time he took his camera out of his bag, it was like drawing a sword to combat indifference, injustice, and discrimination, trying to get rid of stereotypes. Alan Chin is a New York-based photographer who knew Corky Lee. Thanks very much for joining us, Alan, to talk about your friend. Do you remember when you first met him and what struck you about him?
I had seen Corky Lee's photographs even when I was 11, 12, 13 years old as a young Chinese American boy growing up in New York City's Chinatown. They really moved me because we didn't have a lot of Asian Americans documenting our own communities back then. And then many years later, I was working for the New York Times as a regular contributor, and I got a call, an assignment to go down to the Museum of the Chinese in the Americas. And could I photograph photographer Corky Lee?
Wow.
And so it was a pleasure to do so. I met him then for the first time, and many years of friendship and camaraderie since.
I mean, documentary photography style really loosened up in the 60s and 70s. What was Lee's style while he was on the street taking photos? Like, how would he approach a scene and his subjects? Did you have a chance to watch him work?
Yeah, I worked alongside him a number of times. I think like a lot of photographers, it's a mix of seeing what you're just going to come across and get lucky, and a mix, of course, of real intentionality where you look for stuff. You make a list of things. And Corky, more than anyone else I knew, you know, if there was going to be an opening of an exhibition or a community center doing something or a senior center doing something or one of the schools doing something, you know, anything like that, he would do his best to be there and document all those things. And, you know, and he did this for decades.
Did he have to charm his subjects? I mean, I see some documentary photographers and they really engage. I mean, what was that like?
So interestingly enough, Corky did not speak Cantonese or Toishanese or any of the Chinese languages that well. Because he was born in America, he spoke English as his primary language. He understood Cantonese and Toishanese quite well. And I think because he was, like I said, almost the first, or maybe was the first to be doing this, I don't think people gave him that much trouble. They recognized him as one of our own. You know, It's one thing when an outsider comes and just kind of says, you know, I'm really interested in what you're all about. It's another thing entirely when it's someone who's born and bred in the community, even if they don't speak the language that well.
So you're a photographer, Alan, and like Corky Lee, your parents are from China and you grew up in the U.S. You said you'd seen Corky's photos first when you were 10. So how much did he influence your own work? Was he kind of an idol of sorts for you?
I wouldn't say idol because, you know, we're a cynical bunch. But I would say definitely he was one of the leaders, you know, he led the way. He made it possible for all of us, Chinese and Americans and Asian Americans in a way, because we all kind of walk in his footsteps, you know. Definitely he was an inspiration.
Notably on his business card, Corky Lee identified himself as the, quote, undisputed unofficial Asian American photographer laureate. There's a bit of a self-brag there, but did you ever have the chance to talk to Lee about what that meant more deeply? Like, what does it mean to be a photographer representing an entire group of people the way he did?
I think I'll answer that question by talking about something he did just 2 years ago now. He actually started it about 5 or 6 years ago. the anniversaries were coming up of the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad across the United States. And there's that very famous photograph of the two steam engines meeting, and it's filled with workers. And if you look at it, none of those workers are Chinese, even though up to 15,000 Chinese workers helped build that railroad.
I'm actually going to jump in, Alan, because we have a moment of Corky Lee talking about what he saw in those photographs. Let's hear that.
So in every social studies history book, there's that famous photograph of the two locomotives facing each other and all these people in front of the locomotives. So I figured, well, if the Chinese built the railroad, you know, let me go see how many Chinese there were. Looked at the history book, still not a single Chinese. I said, if you read about something and you don't see it, then where are they?
So Alan Chin, years later, how did Corky Lee address that?
So he started organizing Chinese Americans to gather to recreate and reenact that photograph with Chinese Americans and Asian Americans. And of course, the biggest was a couple of years ago at the 150th anniversary, where a group of 600 of us all gathered, and it was part of the larger celebration. And Corky had a ladder, he had a loudspeaker, and you know, it's not easy to corral 500 people. But he did.
I saw that photo of him on the ladder taking that picture. It's pretty impressive. I want to just go back to how he influenced you. Is there one photograph that you kind of feel is the essence of Corky Lee? And kind of what is it and how does it make you feel?
Well, I'm going to answer this question personally. So a few years ago in 2014, there was a big exhibition called Inclusion Exclusion. It was the first major museum exhibition about the Chinese immigrant experience in the United States. And it was at the New York Historical Society up on Central Park West. And I went and I was with my then partner, Elizabeth. And all of a sudden, Elizabeth points at this photograph on the wall and she says, "Alan, isn't that your great uncle?" And I did this double take because, of course, he'd been dead for many, many years, decades. And Elizabeth, of course, had only seen him in my family photos. And yet she recognized him on the wall. And so I looked closer and I realized it's a Corky Lee photo. Of course it is. And it's a photo of my great uncle, Sing Chan, getting his blood pressure taken in Columbus Park in Chinatown in 1971, at a moment when I would have been 3 months old. But there they were. And Corky, as a young activist photographer, had been there photographing it. And all these years later, it was on the wall of the New York Historical Society on Central Park West. I can't tell you how wonderful that made me feel.
That's amazing. Photographer Alan Chin speaking with us about the life and legacy of photographer Corky Lee, who died last week as a result of COVID-19. Alan, thank you very much for helping us remember your friend.
Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.